Hi, everyone. My name is Joe. I'm alcoholic.
Hi, Joe.
My sobriety date's January 1st, 1987. Got a sponsor and a home group, and I'm honored to be here. I really want to thank Billy for asking me to come down and speak. And they gave me a CD of the last talk that I gave at this group, which was in 2007. So we have a storied history, the two of us and me coming down here. But I hope your expectations are kind of my talk are kind of, you know, medium, you know. Billy rubs elbows with, like, AA royalty and stuff, but I'm just a regular guy. I'm just a guy who really, really loved alcohol and messed everything up possible multiple times until I, you know, was out of options, you know, and then came into AA begrudgingly. You know, the typical story. And I'm an alcoholic who began down the road of active alcoholism the very first time I took a drink of alcohol. I had the magic, allergic, unnatural, or just a different type of reaction to alcohol that happens to only a fraction amount of the human beings that drink alcohol. And it happened immediately. I experienced a first night of drinking a kinship with my fellow man that rivals those kinds of experiences that I have today, although today they're more frequent and they last longer, and which is one of the reasons why I prefer being sober. And I almost forgot, I usually start out with, make no mistake about it, I want to be sober today more than anything else in my life. And I'm 29 years, just celebrating my 29th AA birthday. And my sobriety is the most important thing to me. And it's the most important thing to everybody around me who genuinely loves and cares for me. And because not having sobriety impacts them greatly as well as myself. And, you know, so I started down the road of alcoholism. You know, some people, their stories kind of unfold. You know, they drank a little bit and then, you know, slowly it eroded or however it happens where, you know, alcohol plays a bigger and bigger role in their life and they wake up and they're like, oh my God, I'm in the middle of this and I don't know how'd I get here. I saw like drinking every day and doing all that and getting wasted all the time and ran towards it as fast as I could with all of, like from the first night I drank, I immediately rearranged every priority in my life. Matter of fact, I cleared my schedule, you know, of all priorities. It was just done that night. And that's all I wanted to do. I remember, you know, I mean, I drank in my first, like, night where I really got drunk and was drinking with my friends and stuff was in the parking garage of a building that was still under construction that later would be the office building where my attorney was that got me out of a bunch of the trouble that I got into later in my drinking, you know what I mean? It's like AA is full of, you know, my life's full of stuff that came full circle, right? And, but man, I mean, from that first night, I could not wait to continue that way of life, you know? I felt like I had met so many people that night, and I mean, prior to that, I was just like a normal teenager, you know, a little bit nervous, trying to figure out what the heck's going on in the world. Everybody else has got a roadmap. I don't. And really, even for teenagers who are not alcoholic, that's not unusual to feel a little bit awkward, you know, in the teenage years and stuff. Right now in my life, I'm in the process of, I'm engaged, I'm about to get married, and she had three teenage boys, and I've been with her for some years, so I've gotten to watch them kind of go through their teenage years, and they're not drinkers, thank God. But just to watch sort of some of that awkwardness, you know, I had that. And, you know, but for most teenagers, when they take a drink, it doesn't solve it. But for me, a drink of alcohol solved that problem. It didn't just help it take the edge off it. It solved it for the entire period I was wasted. And, so that's what I wanted to do. That was my new goal in life. And so there's things that have to be done to maintain that way of life. Number one, must start to live a double life. It's got to happen. Because, you know, my mom, the people in my life, you know, teachers, and, you know, people who are kind of like giving you the roadmap to life, like, you know, do right, discipline, you know, all the things they were against, I started to become for, you know. And so I immediately was portraying an image to them and then doing what I really, my passion over here, which was, you know, get drunk all the time and party and, you know, escape, a life of escape. I loved it. And for about 2 years or so, that's pretty much how my life went. You know, in school, I just had friends everywhere. I mean, it just seemed like once I started partying, I met all the partiers, and it's like my world was expanding, you know, and I was feeling better and better and better. And you know, in the initial phases of my drinking career, I was actually doing better in school. And, you know, I think some of that, I mean, just kind of looking back, like, I had no answer for why it was back then. I just thought it was, you know, I'm finding myself, you know, and discovering, you know, what I'm supposed to be doing with my life. But the reality was, I think I just was, you know, I stopped being so nervous, you know, and I started to relax a little bit. And so I started to actually do a little bit better. But, you know, that only lasted about a year or so, you know, and then it, you know, it took a big nosedive. But, so I was drinking, and for about 2 years was with impunity. You know, like, there's a little line about that in the book where the alcoholic sees other people drinking with impunity, you know, and I would later become envious of people that I would see doing that because it did change for me. But initially, it didn't. And I mean, I could get as drunk as I wanted to, and no matter what, you know, I would end up like, I would pass out, but it'd be like somewhere normal, like a couch, or somehow I made it home, you know, or whatever, and which is another, you know, there was very few episodes, and when I did have episodes, it was like something pretty innocent, you know, like the cops would stop us and then let us go, you know, and that also changed later on. The letting go part of by the Montgomery County's finest stopped happening, and but there I was, you know, into me, I felt like I was at the height of my life. And, but there, you know, it's kind of like one of those weird things where even though that was happening, there was the part of me that during my sober moments, you know, I kind of knew I was lying to everybody, you know, anybody who really cared about me and my life and the direction of it. I mean, I absolutely was hiding everything from them. So like there, that's like, I like to call it an itch, you know. Had this, there, you know, I mean, I was having the time of my life, but there was this itch, you know, and I was like, ah. And, but I kept doing, I kept doing my thing. And around, so I got sober at age 20. I started drinking around, yeah, 14-ish, 15-ish. So right about when I turned 17 is when the change really happened for me. And the change is kind of like, again, you know, for some people, it's this slow erosion where slowly there's a problem here or a problem there, and then they start to compound themselves. But for me, it was like flicking one of those light switches. I went from this, you know, drinking with impunity, having the time of my life, you know, feeling like, you know, the center of my universe is, you know, is full of fellowship, to there was a lot of problems, and it was like I almost couldn't escape having a problem. From the moment the problem started, I couldn't not have them anymore. And so I started having episodes, you know. I'm like one of those alcoholics. I never was a double vision driver. I was more of the it's foggy out driver. So I never saw two of things. It's just the distance that I could see became dramatically shorter the more drunk I was, you know, and I'd just be driving like this. And, you know, I was coming home from a party one night and I was driving on this country road. I mean, it was like, if it was a lane wide, I don't even know, you know, and I'm driving and I'm going under this bridge and it clips one of my mirrors on my car. So I stop. And then I kind of wake up and I have this moment of clarity. I actually wasn't driving on the street. I had stopped in front of an apartment building, and I had clipped the sides of two of the posts of the awning that's out front to keep the rain off of you when you're going into your apartment building. I've been driving on the sidewalk for about 5 minutes. And so I was starting to have stuff like that happen, you know, anomalies, right? Anomalies in behavior. And I started using school as a rally point to find my buddies and just leave school and go party. I right now live in the town where I hit my bottom, and down the hill from my house is this, it's a New York bagel bakery, and I mean, this place is like the real deal. And that was kind of like our secondary staging area every morning. So go to school, you know, typical, go to school, you know, get wasted a little bit, you know. I did a few drugs and stuff like that too. So like sometimes we'd like do a little, you know, smoke some funny cigarettes and go to school, rally up with everybody, find out, you know, who had money, how much money we had, whether it was going to be like, you know, Mad Dog 2020 this morning, or, you know, or if we were going to be able to scale it up, you know, get some beer, some Jim Beam or something. And we would rally up at school and immediately leave and then go down to this bagel place and hang out there and be a nuisance to them for a little while. And then we'd all go to somebody's house and party. And I got away with that for a little while, but you know, the veneer of lying to the parents and brothers and sisters who were just normal people who had, you know, gone to college and stuff like that, and you know, wanted the same, you know, good things for me, that started to erode. People started kind of finding out that my attendance was low in school, and that, you know, and it started to kind of show on me too. You know, one of the things that happened was, you know, when you're in school, or like junior high school or whatever, you know, you have like books and folders for every class. Well, my folders went from having like, you know, logos of like BMX bicycle and skateboarding things to like Budweiser labels. And, you know, I would be drawing like art that had to do with, you know, partying. And then, you know, I guess how I was dressing was kind of changing to more of the, you know, I mean, I had a Jack Daniels hat, so, you know, and so it started to really become apparent to everybody around me, and I just wasn't, I was deteriorating, you know. I was still, you know, still young, relatively healthy and everything, but, you know, if you ever talk to somebody who's really wasted, it can be rough going having a conversation, you know, with them, And so that's what the people in my life were experiencing out of me. I wanted to say, it wasn't that I didn't care. The fact of the matter is, I did not care. I mean, that's just the reality. It's like one of those things that, you know, after being sober a while and doing some inventory, I think sometimes I don't want to see myself as ever having been that pig-faced selfish, but I certainly was. And I just didn't care. And so that's how I was living my life, just 100% selfishness, you know, all day, every day. And, you know, so I just kind of kept moving forward with my life, you know. And, yeah, I don't even know what I was focused on. I just really, all I wanted was to party. I mean, when I look back at it now, I was like, God, I was such an idiot. I mean, like, I wasn't even trying to pass classes and stuff like that. I just was, like, getting wasted, and that was it. But I guess I just wanted to ride it out as far as I could, you know. I think I just mostly didn't want to think about it. I wanted to keep that sense of ease and comfort that comes at once after taking a few drinks. But I couldn't, I also had no way to, like, shut it off before I went, you know, before I overfilled. because I drank, the later into my drinking, the more I drank like somebody who looked like they were trying to kill themselves with alcohol. But I couldn't stop. I mean, I would try to not do that to myself on a given night and do it to myself anyways. And that happened, that washing machine of a process would happen over and over and over, you know, and new desperate attempts to change my behavior, you know, would be followed by, you know, like our book says, a still worse relapse. And but I hadn't even started. By age 17, you know, when I was kind of bottoming out and I started losing credit in a bunch of classes in school, I still wasn't even, I didn't even have as like a secondary thought, like, maybe I should do something else with my life besides just try to get wasted all the time. It just still, it probably, that probably didn't show up until, you know, I was turned 18, really. And when I turned 18, interestingly enough, it seemed like the Montgomery County Police Department was kind of waiting around for me to turn 18. Because prior to being 18, it's like I never got stopped by the cops, or if I ever did, it was just a brief interchange and nothing really came of it. But then when I turned 18, they were everywhere and they were all over me. Like, they had my number. Every time I was doing something wrong, I was going to jail for it. It was very bad. You know, I was not, the percentages were not working out for me too well. And, you know, I had gotten a DWI one night. I was driving back from this big party that I was going to, and I was driving fine. And, I actually was, like, probably once in my life, right? I was driving down the road. My sister was in the passenger seat, and one of her girlfriends was in the middle seat. And I had this this old Chevelle, and a 76 Chevelle, man. That thing was awesome, but it had a bench seat, you know, old school. And so there was three of us sitting there, and so a cop comes up behind me with his high beams on, so I can't see the flashers on top of the car because the light kind of washes it out. So I didn't know. There was a cop behind me. I'm just driving, and my sister's getting all mad because this guy's got his brakes on behind me. So I'm driving, and then she leans out the window and, you know, gives him, you know, the one-finger salute. And I immediately get pulled over and busted and taken to jail. And that kind of started my, you know, my institutional instruction. That's a pretty diplomatic way to put it, but so I got there. I got my attorney, the guy in the building from where I took my first drink, right? And, you know, he was, thank God I have a mommy that likes me, you know, because that's who really bailed me out. I mean, she paid the money. This guy was very expensive, and I found out if you pay a lot of money, you can get out of trouble. And that's basically what happened, you know. I got what I like to call peanut butter and jelly, which is probation before judgment, and on my DWI. So I had to meet some conditions, and then it went away like it never existed on my record. And but back in 1983, that cost a lot of money. But I was perfectly willing for her to pay that for me to get out of trouble. And so I had to start coming to some alcohol awareness classes. And I remember I went to meet this guy, and he was like the intake officer. And it's so funny to like have what I experienced in that moment and then kind of look back now. You know, the guy was sober, like double digit sobriety, and he probably took one look at me and I'm like, this kid's a mess, you know, and asked me a few questions. And so he did. He asked me probably 10 or 15 questions. Then he said, okay, you are in the mid to late stages of alcoholism, and you know, you're having some other issues with yourself mentally and stuff. And you know, because I think I was like, I don't know how, I was probably acting crazy in his office. Who knows what I was doing? I mean, I can't really remember. I just remember being outraged. I was like, you've known me for like 2 minutes. You've asked me 10 questions, and you're telling me you think you know who I am and what I am, and blah 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 blah. And I was like, this is a setup. It's a whole scam. I see your operation here. You got your little people. You make them sit in the chairs and pay you money and all this stuff. I mean, I just went crazy. And but he was right. I didn't know it at the time either. I mean, you know, looking back on it, I could see that stuff now. But I was furious, you know. And I renounced everything that happened in that room in my intake. And but I started going to these classes because probation before judgment. That was, you know, that I didn't have very many goals in my life, but not having a not having a rap sheet that somebody can go back to was kind of a goal, to stay off paper, what I like to call off paper. And so I did go to their little classes. I played their little game. And I started learning something about what alcohol does to an alcoholic and stuff like that. And I started learning some other stuff and what the beginning, middle, and late stages of alcoholism can look like, you know. And they showed, like, I got to kind of give it to this little school that I went to. I mean, they did a pretty thorough job of showing, like, a fair cross-section of humanity and then, like, what can happen and what, you know, some of the typical things that sort of set up in the life of an alcoholic. And so I learned something while trying not to learn anything. And, you know, it was just getting in. You know, they were corrupting me, brainwashing me. Not really. And but I was learning something, like actual facts. You know, I mean, most of my life was lived in a fantasy world, like a dream world. Like, you know, it's viable to get wasted all the time and drink your head off and have a good and happy life. That is a delusion. And but I had it, and I held on to it for years. So there was plenty of that, but some facts were kind of starting to get in. And, you know, you remember I said a few minutes ago that to continue a life of alcoholism requires, number one, to live a double life. And that started to really bother me. Because there was like more than one department of life where it was starting to cause problems. You know, and I was having other things happen, you know, like I said, you know, once I started having episodes, I was having a lot of episodes. And so my life is sort of starting to not work. I had already failed out of school. You know, when I would drink, I was starting to get what one of my friend's mom said called nasty. She's like, "You're a nasty drunk." I was like, "What?" I was offended. It was true, but man, it's hard. Doses of reality can be rough, you know, when you live your entire life in denial. It's like it's a real slap in the face. And so I started to become like nasty and surly, and I was still lying to everybody in my life, even though they would say, "Did you do this?" And I would say, "No." And they're like, "I know you're lying. It's written right here. Like, there's a report on what you did." Like, no, you know. And, you know, still lying to everybody. And it was starting to really get to me, to be honest with you. And I started, around the same time, I started having this thing happen inside my stomach where the best way I can explain it is how it actually occurred at the time. It sounded like the seconds hand on a watch ticking real fast. And it was like a countdown. Like I started feeling like I'm running out of time. And the closest thing that I related to from hearing people talking in AA meetings later on in my drinking and into my sobriety was, you know, this sense of impending doom. You know, but for me, the way it occurred in my mind was time is running out. And at the end of this, whenever the fuse gets to the end or the time runs down, something very, very bad. Not like a car wreck or somebody shouts at me, or, you know, I fail something, but something really bad. And this sick feel, I was having this sick feeling in my stomach. And this, there was this gnawing fear that started to follow me everywhere. And there, I couldn't escape it with my normal amount of over drinking. So I had to drink to oblivion to get rid of it. I had to wipe it out. And so I started to do that. I started to wipe it out. And, you know, I think the only reason I didn't die, you know, really probably is because I started having to plan my nights around oblivion. Because it's real tough to function in oblivion. So you got to get to a spot and kind of stick it out there until, you know, the storm blows over. And so I was doing stuff like that. And I started waking up in the middle of the night in these, just soaked in sweat and hyperventilating. And I'd have to run across my bedroom and then kind of crouch down to try and regain control of my breathing and stuff like that. And I found out, you know, I'd been sober for a little while before I found out those are called night terrors. And I had them. I had them real bad. And, you know, it was part of this, you know, the clock's ticking down and the gnawing anxiety and all this stuff. And my conscience, you know, was getting to me. And, you know, I just, because somewhere inside me I knew something wasn't right, but I didn't have another avenue. I just didn't. And you know, I even, like, my last 6 months of drinking, or probably my last year of drinking, I started fooling around with sobriety. And when I say that, I don't mean fooling around with being in AA. I mean fooling around with just not taking a drink as an experiment. And so I started doing that, but that really was not good. That was a bad experiment. And because I can't do sobriety. I'm not good at it. I don't take to it very well. I'm just not, it doesn't suit me. And so I would try to not drink, and I would feel great, you know, for like a week, because I would start to, you know, the color would come back in my face a little bit. I would start to feel okay, and I would start to be able to show up somewhere. But then after about a week or into my second week, you know, it's like the fears and the regrets and, you know, the lack of understanding of how life works. You know, I was all the way back to the nervous 14-year-old who's like, what's going on around here? Anybody know? You know, and of course your next buddy next to you is like, everybody knows except you. You know, and if you're really insecure, that kills you. You know, if you're not insecure, you're just like, whatever, you don't know anything. You know, but I didn't know that at the time. And so I'm back to the same, this is what's going on in my mind, you know. And so I figured out that I can stay sober without going completely insane for right around 3 weeks. And that's it. It's as far down that road as I can ever go on my own unaided will. It's as far as I can do it. It made me totally insane my last year of drinking, trying to not drink. I mean, I just went nuts, you know. And I like, there's a lot of speakers that talk about that's the madness of alcoholism, you know, the getting drunk, getting sober over and over. And, you know, the drinking life gets so wild, you know, so crazy that it's untenable. Then I try to straighten up and do right or you know, be sober for a little while. Then that's untenable. Then I got to go back, and then I got to go back and forth and back and forth. And because the crazy experiment of the first drink has always worked for me. If I need to wipe out a problem, all I have to do is take one drink, and then everything about me takes over to, you know, to make me drink for oblivion until the problem is wiped out. And alcohol has always worked for that. But towards the end of my drinking, you know, I was feeling like I might die soon. Like that the timer was up. And so my last night of drinking was New Year's Eve, 1986. That was my 20th birthday. I'm a New Year's Eve baby. And I had promised to do the following. I was only going to have a couple drinks, number one. I had set some ground rules because I went to my alcohol awareness class. They talked a little bit about, you know, people who are able to manage, you know, like the medium drinkers or whatever, and, you know, you try to put yourself in the best category you can, you know, unless forced into a higher category, but which came the next day. But up till then, it was like a couple drinks, no drugs, and I'm not going to chase girls. I'm in a committed relationship. So I go to this hotel, and I just sort of had a moment of clarity about a half hour after I got there. I was already pretty lit we just did a bunch of shots right when I got there, and I was running, and I just had this moment of clarity as we were running down the hall to get high with these girls, that I hadn't been there an hour, and every single resolve that I had was completely abandoned. And so I sort of drank out that night. Actually, I got so wasted so early that I missed the actual celebrating of New Year's and woke up in a semi-state of sobriety at like 2 a.m. You know, like I woke up, I'm sure I was still, you know, a little bit drunk, but I was with me and I couldn't escape me. And it was like 2 a.m. and the place is a mess. And I was sitting on a couch. And, you know, it's just another conversation with myself about how this has to stop. And I white knuckled it in my bedroom for about 4 or 5 days, and I'd had some exposure to AA. You know, I had to get some court slips signed until I figured out you could forge them, and then we stopped having experiences with AA after that. And but something happened, you know, 7 days, 6 or 7 days sober in the sobriety I have right now is the only time in my life that I can recall where I actually contemplated the taking of my own life. Because I realized that I couldn't continue that cycle. I couldn't drink and I couldn't stay sober either. I was stuck forever. It was never going to change. And, you know, in that ultimate, what they call the nadir of my alcoholism, which is the lowest point, there's just an idea. Go to the 6 o'clock meeting at the clubhouse around the corner. And I was like, all right, I'm going to give that a try. I said, I'm going to give it one chance, though. Tonight's it. I'm going to go there, I'm going to listen to what these people have to say, and if it doesn't work, I'm done. I'm checking out. So I didn't have wheels at the time. I asked my mom to... My mom dropped me off at AA. It's so awesome. That looks so cool when you're 20. Have your mom drop you off in front of the AA clubhouse. But she was watching a TV show, so she couldn't take me to the 6 o'clock meeting till 7 o'clock, which is when they're saying the Lord's Prayer and the Serenity Prayer in my area. And so they were doing that when I walked into the clubhouse. And, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is full of some of the greatest people in the world. Because I walked in the room, they opened up the circle, I started holding people's hands, and then I started to share. And which, if you're in an AA meeting and somebody starts to share during the prayers, it's a little bit of a party foul. There's no doubt about it. You know, that's not something you're going to see every day. And I knew I was desperate, and that's why I said, because I knew I knew I was sharing out of turn, and but I kept it pretty tight. I just asked for help basically in about 10 seconds, and you know, we finished up with the prayer. You know, it's funny. You know, they stopped the prayer, let me share for a second, finished the prayers, and then I got surrounded by people in Alcoholics Anonymous. They did what they do to newcomers. They took me immediately to a pancake house, shoved me full of pancakes. You know, so you're like, when you don't eat a lot and you just, you know, you drink a lot of whiskey, you know, you get a couple pancakes in you, you're not going anywhere in a hurry. It's like, I was like, man. And they just started pitching AA to me like crazy, you know. And these guys were, you know, I was 20 years old, and these guys were kind of younger, you know, a couple years older or whatever, and had a little bit of sobriety, and were telling me everything, you know. Oh, my God, it's going to be so great. And I'm thinking, I don't think I'm like these people, but I'm really glad that somebody's trying to help me. And I went home from that experience that night, not filled with hope. You know, I felt hopeless, but it felt good for somebody to care about me. I don't know how to explain it. You know, it wasn't like I had some major identification with what they said or anything. And you know, one of the guys was like, "All right, we're going to get together tomorrow night." And I met him up at a meeting and started hanging out with these guys on a regular basis. And, you know, it's really funny because I had this reservation when I actually got sober in the sobriety I have today. And that was, you know, the 3-week rule. After about 3 weeks, there's just something inside me that says, you're going to need to take a drink in the next 30 minutes. Let's go. And I was kind of knew that was going to be about my limit with AA, but I wanted to just ride it out. You know, it felt nice to be around these guys, and they were telling me some crazy stories about their drunkenness, and I kind of related to that. I told them some of my crazy stories, like, oh yeah, one time we caught the Chevelle on fire, and then, you know, it was snowing, so we just threw a bunch of snow on the engine and smoked a couple cigarettes, and the fire was out, and we just shut the hood and kept going. You know, and just like all these, you know, had NASCAR style crashes and stuff. And so I was relating to that, but like these guys were happy about that they were sober. And like that seemed impossible to me. So I couldn't be like them. But I kept hanging around them, and they railroaded me into getting this guy for a sponsor. His name was Frank, and Frank was he's a New Jersey Italian. You know what I mean? That just has laid back written all over it, right? if you're, I don't know how new anybody is or if you're in the process of finding a sponsor or whatever, but I heard that man share one time for 2 minutes, and I asked him to sponsor me. And that worked out for 23 years until he died suddenly sober. You know, best of friends and the best mentor I've ever had. But he was like super nice to me for like 24 to 48 hours. I mean, like just anything I wanted, right? And then after that, he was actually always nice to me. He would actually almost never raise his voice once in a while. But almost never raise his voice, and it would just seem like he's yelling at me, because what he would tell me is the truth, you know, which I'm allergic to. So, you know, after a day or so, you know, he had this whole list of things that he wanted me to do, and it was like four things. It was more than I could remember, which proved to be the case, because eventually he made me actually get a sheet of paper, write his four directions down, fold it, and keep it in my front pocket with my money. You know, I'm like, what am I, 8 years old? You know, which, like, probably. But I couldn't remember the directions. I was so burned out. I was, like, toasted on both sides. I was functionally illiterate. I could read the words on the page, and then, you know, if he would say, all right, what'd you get out of that? That's it. It's like there's no, it's a blank slate. As soon as I'm done reading, the slate is wiped clean, like an Etch-a-Sketch, you know? It's done. I wasn't exactly given AA. Like, I had reservations. I couldn't read. I couldn't remember anything. Four of the seven meetings I went to during the week were on the same road, and it took me like 2 months to figure out which meeting on what night and what part of the road. And, you know, I was just a disaster, but, you know, AA likes people like that, you know. And, you know, I was sponsored by my sponsor, and I've sponsored a bunch of guys like that who've made it and, you know, become and stayed sober. And so he started me on step work in a little bit of an unconventional way, and then we went back and did it the exact conventional way. You know, at first it was like, you know, why don't you go do this? Or, you know, like he just had me start to help do some service. And then I had three things that no newcomer barely ever has. I had a car that was registered in the state I lived in, like a valid registration and a valid driver's license, you know? And he was like, you know, it's like the jackpot, right? So he was like, look, this is what I want you to do, is fill up your car with alcoholics and take them to meetings. He's like, I was like, man, I don't know anything about AA. And he was like, I don't care about that. I just need you to go, just pick guys up and take them to the meeting. You know, you carry them to the message. And so I started doing that. You know, I became like a local taxi service and dispenser of free cigarettes in the D.C. metropolitan area. You know, everybody's bumming a cigarette off of me. And I started catching on fire for AA. I mean, it was like, you know, and all this time, Frank's reading to me out of the big book, you know, and explaining everything to me. And then we would go to meetings, and he'd be like, what'd you hear in that meeting? I'd be like, oh, I heard this. And he'd be like, wrong. This is what they said. You know, re-explain everything I just heard. And it's funny, you know, God, sometimes we would go to these awful meetings. And when I'm new, I had so much negativity that, if I heard something negative, it actually comforted me. You know, so like, we went to this one meeting, and Frank's just like, I can see he's suffering in this meeting. Like, he just, whatever, something's happening that he doesn't like. So we get out of the meeting, he's like, man, what'd you think of that meeting? I was like, oh my God, it was amazing, man. Some people were really getting honest. And he was like, oh my God, I thought you were going to drink after that meeting. That might have been the worst AA meeting I've ever been to in my life. But, you know, for whatever reason, I was so broken inside that I needed to sit right next to somebody who I felt like was as broken as me to feel like I was okay in the seat I was in. Like, I used to literally, I would go to meetings, and if I saw a guy who was shaking and couldn't hold his cup, if I sat next to him, that comforted me. I felt so shattered on the inside. And I just looked like a 20-year-old kid. I mean, I have pictures of me at 20 years old getting sober. And I just looked like a regular kid, but I was a shattered human being on the inside. And all this time I'm going to AA, you know, and I'm getting on fire for stuff, which doesn't mean anything for my level of crazy. You know, I just was nuts. But, you know, I would have these experiences where just there would be a little shining light inside me that would light up for a little bit. And then, you know, I'd be back to like just total insanity, you know, just thinking crazy and nervous, neurotic, insecure all the time. But I started doing this stuff. And, you know, Frank and I started formalizing the process of the steps a little bit more. And matter of fact, you know, from him reading the big book to me, we read the big book with a dictionary. If I didn't understand a word in the book, we'd look it up in the dictionary. If he didn't understand a word in the book, I would look it up in the dictionary. You know what I mean? You got to know your place, right? And but from that sprung this. There's a Tuesday book study that I go to every Tuesday night, and it's like my secondary home group. And that came out of that living room, because a couple of his other guys, after he started sponsoring other guys, started being like, "Hey, that's no fair." And so then we all started reading in his apartment, and the girls wanted to, they were in our group, were like, "That's no fair, just the guys, you know." And then eventually he's like, "Yeah, we got to get a room." And that's been a great tradition. But he started teaching me about, I started learning about alcoholism, but he started teaching me a little more formally about the allergy of the body, the obsession of the mind, and stuff like that, teaching me about the fatal nature of my condition, which I had to be probably 3 or 4 months sober before I could even comprehend. If somebody came at me with that in my first 2 weeks of sobriety, it would have been wasted air. I just had no ability. There wasn't enough inside to catch whatever was being thrown at me, you know. But, you know, and Frank was he's a really smart guy, you know. I think he really had my number. And thank God. I mean, I don't know. I would be dead if it wasn't for him and the people in my home group and stuff just surrounding me, helping me initially feel comforted and buy me enough time to where I could thaw out enough and a little bit of the fog lift to where some of the message could get in and learn about the fatal nature of my malady. And, you know, by the time I was like 7 or 8 months sober, like 4 or 5 of my first running buddies had like been here and are not here. And so I sort of went through this moment of clarity where I was like, so if I don't slowly change everything about my nature and how I react to life, I'm not going to make it. Period. That, like, the getting of the first step, when I go over the first step with guys that I sponsor, I don't say, you're going to experience a lot of relief when you get the first step. It's in a step of emergency, at least to me. That's how when I was like, I now understand the first step, I was like, stuff's got to happen right now because this is an emergency, you know, 3 alarm. and that propelled me into at least understanding that I had to have a spiritual way of life or there was virtually no chance I was going to make it. None. Like, in the, like, zero, like, not even like, it's sort of snuffed out like, well, every now and then there's exceptions to the rule and you could possibly, I knew I didn't have that kind of potential. I was not, you know, I was dumb, but I wasn't an idiot, right? And so I started down this spiritual path, and around the same time, I had a lot of ideas about what that meant. And that started to really bother me. And like a good alcoholic, I didn't tell anybody. It was bothering me like crazy. Matter of fact, I was dying over it. All by myself. You know, I mean, my sponsor didn't know. I'd just tell him whatever I was telling him. And, you know, say, are you praying? Yeah. I'm doing all this. But I had all these ideas, and they were driving me crazy. And so it's like the usual thing for, like, a newer alcoholic, you know. The game is to pretend you're fine until you're about to be committed to a mental institution, and then you finally just say, I'm not fine. I'm a mess. I've been a mess, you know, for, like, 2 months. You're like, what? You know? And so I run all this by Frank, you know. It's like, and, you know, of course, it's like, you know, a Gone with the Wind story on his couch and stuff. And he had this couch that was like, it was leather, but not all the way leather. It was like pleather. We used to call it the crying couch, you know what I mean? You can wipe anything off that couch. Don't worry about it. Just let it go, man, let it go, right? And so I'm on the crying couch and telling him that I can't have a relationship with God. It's impossible. And I started, he's like, what are you talking about? And I started telling him, you know, I was like, I can't even explain it to you. It just, it all comes at me and I can't decide what's what and who's who. And he's like, all right, time out. He's like, for most alcoholics, we have a thing that we say, you know, the result's nil until we let go of all of our old ideas. But you're extra sick. I get it. You know, this is what we're going to do with you. I said, he's like, I don't want you to get rid of any of this stuff. I was like, I know you can't figure it out. And I said, I'm just saying, instead of trying to figure out all this stuff right now, he said, it's not necessary for what we need to do. I said, but I don't want you to get rid of it either. Hang on to it, you know, right here if you want. Right there. So what we're going to do is, if you're up for it, let's do an experiment. Then we're going to take these ideas and we're going to set them right here for right now. And then me and you are going to take actions in Alcoholics Anonymous for a period of 8 weeks. Then after 8 weeks, based on your own sober experience, we can go back through the stuff and see if any of it makes any sense to us. And I could tell you that that was one of the great spiritual things that has ever happened for me, because I couldn't let go of this. It was stuck to me. But the way he helped me do it, I was free to explore a spiritual way of life without any encumbrances. And we now, after 8 weeks was gone, we never went back to the tangled up ball of fish and string. We just did it. You know, something freed up in me in that moment, and I became to understand and know a God of my understanding, you know, a little bit, you know, and then things started happening, you know. It's amazing, you know, and I decided to go, I went deeper into the steps, you know. I he had to wait for a little while to me. I know a lot of people, you know, it's real important, you know, you get in and you get up to step four and do it as fast as you can, but I'm telling you, I was at 20 years old, I was like a punch drunk fighter. I mean, I just was kind of like wheeling around, you know, and pretending I was way better off than I really was, you know. And but he kind of knew my deal, you know. So he didn't have me do my four step till I was probably, you know, a year sober. You know, right around a year sober, I'm like, step four. We're gonna talk about step four. Have we ever talked about step four? And like, all right, take your four step. And then I ignored it for like 3 months, right? I wrote down one name and it freaked me out so bad I hid the thing under my bed until my butt was on such fire 2.5 months later that I wrote the entire thing in 3 hours. It's like, you know, if it wasn't for, you know, I mean, I'm just, everything when somebody says, you know, real sick alcoholics tend to do this. That's something that I've got some experience with, drunk and sober, you know, our adventures before and after, right? So I take this four step, and of course, when I finished with my four step, I immediately called him because I was, if I am anything, I'm spirited. I got stuff is going inside of me, you know. Even if I'm just like this on the outside, it's going. So I call him up. I'm like, I'm done with the four step, and he's like, all right, let's schedule your fifth step. I was like, I'll be right over. And he's like, wait a minute, man. And it's like 10 o'clock at night or whatever, you know. He's like, wait a minute. And I was like, I got to do it right now or I'm never going to do it. And he's like, all right, we'll do it tomorrow, you know. And I went and did my fifth step with him. And I told him, you know, almost everything. You know, it's like, you know, alcohol, check, right? Told him almost everything, but, you know, again, you know, this man loved me, and he had my number, and he said, is that it? Yep, that's it. I said, are you sure that's it? That's it. Are you sure that's it? Well, yeah. And I told him the last couple of things, which is stuff that's just not even that big of a deal, but for whatever reason, it was stuff that was like a bridge too far for me to be able to ever accept myself as being okay, or, you know. And, you know, he taught me how to love myself as a sick, he didn't really focus very much on loving myself, but accept myself as a sick person getting well. He was like, look, you know, lots happened. You're a sick person getting well. And I eventually started to accept that, you know, and I knew that I was on a path. And after doing that fifth step, I started feeling a sense of belonging, a long-term sense of belonging, something that had some permanence to it. You know, not just a fleeting experience like when you accidentally do something for somebody else when you're brand new and you're like, that kind of felt good. You know, it's like long-term things are happening and my spirit's developing, you know, and I wanted to go further and I took the 8-step. And as soon as I finished my 8-step list, I went over it with my sponsor, and there was a couple of people on that list I was convinced I would never see again. Like, I just was like, I don't know how to find these people. There was no Facebook. I mean, when I did mine, there, you know, mobile phones were still this big. I mean, you know. So, and I pulled up to a stoplight, and somebody was on my 8-step list was standing there with a volunteer fireman's boot collecting money for a charity for a thing. And that was, you know, it was like one of those double takes, like, that's him. And I pulled up right next to him, and like within the time it took that red light to go from red to green again, that amends was done, and I floated across that intersection knowing that God was in my life, loved me, and wanted good things for me, and was actively watching out for me. And I've had so many experiences like that, you know, and sobriety is the number one thing in my life. I still got 5 minutes, right, or 3 minutes or something. Like, yeah, we're... So I've had so many things in my life that have happened of a spiritual nature, you know, from the time when I used to spend a night a week at my mom's house doing whatever she wanted to do right before the Wednesday night meeting. And one night I came in the driveway and she turned around and just smiled and looked at me. And I had this moment of clarity that Alcoholics Anonymous transformed my life, because I realized all the fear, all the apprehension, all the anxiety about me, who I am, my future, everything was gone from her. And she just was like seeing the son that she loves. He's living a nice, happy life. It was pretty amazing. And then, you know, and then stuff started happening out of left field, you know, of a personal nature. You know, I graduated high school on my third try. And my sponsor, being the tyrant that he is, made me go back to school in what I do for a profession. And, you know, stuff started happening. I started traveling around the world with people in AA, going to conferences and doing all kinds of stuff and just living a vital life. And, you know, that most of the amazing things in my life have come right out of left field. The woman I'm engaged to was actually introduced to me almost 4 years ago by just a friend of mine randomly in AA, who was like, oh, hey, I was just thinking about you. There's this girl that I've been thinking is just right for you for about 2 years. I'm like, 2 years? 2 years? Come on, man. Set me up. Something. So we went and had coffee, you know, and been together ever since, and we just got engaged, and we're about to get married this summer. And I wasn't focusing on meeting anybody, and it happened. You know, and that my life is like that. I have this job now that is ridiculous. It's so far beyond my capacity. If I think, am I capable of that? No. But I have it, and I'm good at it. And I got to, like, open up this ledger from the 1800s, and it's a pretty prominent position. So everybody from, like, the first guy who signed it, and I'm number 14, is from 1895. And I got to open that book, take out a pen, and sign my name in it. And I was like, that doesn't happen to somebody like me. I'm an alcoholic who cannot stop drinking. I don't feel good sober, you know. And for that to happen and for me to have my life transformed, and I feel good like all the time, but it's because there's a God in my life. It's because there's people in my life. I'm 29 years sober, and I need you to stay sober, believe me. I have a pretty good intuition about things, and I make a fair amount of good decisions, but it's like a bent fender. You could straighten that thing out till you're blue in the face, but it's always going to be a little bent, you know? And that's just kind of how I am. I hope I always remember that about myself, and I maintain that enough of that humility that I continually run ideas by my sponsor. And when he says, hey, let's chat about this one thing that you're talking about in here that I noticed, let's talk about that for a minute before we move forward, you know? And as long as I keep... I just hope I always stay willing to do that, because it's made my life something incredible. And I love being in AA. The best human beings in the entire world are right here in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope I'm always remembered. Thank you.